was one race he wasn't going to win. But he tried hard, and he was gaining on the rabbit again when it dropped into a small hole in the side of a small and easy hill. The hole was overgrown by long grasses, and Cujo didn't hesitate. He lowered his big, tawny body into a kind of furry projectile and let his forward motion carry him in, where he promptly stuck like a cork in a bottle. Joe Camber had owned Seven Oaks Farm out at the end of Town Road Number 3 for 17 years, but he had no idea this hole was there. He surely would have discovered it if farming was his business, but it wasn't. There was no livestock in the big red barn. It was his garage and auto body shop. His son, Brett, rambled the fields and woods behind the home place frequently, but he had never noticed the hole either, although on several occasions he had nearly put his foot in it, which might have earned him a broken ankle. On clear days, the hole could pass for a shadow. On cloudy days, overgrown with grass as it was, it disappeared altogether. John Mousam, the farm's previous owner, had known about the hole but had never thought to mention it to Joe Camber when Joe bought the place in 1963. He might have mentioned it as a caution when Joe and his wife Charity had their son in 1970, but by then the cancer had carried old John off. It was just as well Brett had never found it. There's nothing in the world quite so interesting to a boy as a hole in the ground. And this one opened on a small natural limestone cave. It was about 20 feet deep at its deepest, and it would have been quite possible for a small, squirty boy to eel his way in, slide to the bottom, and then find it impossible to get out. It had happened to other small animals in the past. The cave's limestone surface made a good slide, but a bad climb, and its bottom was littered with bones. A woodchuck, a skunk, a couple of chipmunks, a couple of squirrels, and a house cat. The house cat's name had been Mr. Clean. The Cambers had lost him 2 years before and assumed he had been hit by a car or had just run off. But here he was, along with the bones of the good-sized field mouse he had chased inside. Cujo's rabbit had rolled and slid all the way to the bottom and now quivered there, ears up and nose vibrating like a tuning fork, as Cujo's furious barking filled the place. The echoes made it sound as though there was a whole pack of dogs up there. The small cave had also attracted bats from time to time. Never many, because the cave was only a small one, but its rough ceiling made a perfect place for them to roost upside down and snooze the daylight away. The bats were another good reason that Brett Camber had been lucky, especially this year. This year, the brown insectivorous bats inhabiting the small cave were crawling with a particularly virulent strain of rabies. Cujo had stuck at the shoulders. He dug furiously with his back legs to no effect at all. He could have reversed and pulled himself back out, but for now, he still wanted the rabbit. He sensed it was trapped, his for the taking. His eyes were not particularly keen. His large body blocked out almost all the light anyway, and he had no sense of the drop just beyond his front paws. He could smell damp, and he could smell bat guano, both old and fresh. But most important of all, he could smell rabbit, hot and tasty. Dinner is served. His barking roused the bats. They were terrified. Something had invaded their home. They flew en masse toward the exit, squeaking. But their sonar recorded a puzzling and distressing fact. The entrance was no longer there. The predator was where the entrance had been. They wheeled and swooped in the darkness, their membranous wings sounding like small pieces of clothing, diapers perhaps, flapping from a line in a gusty wind. Below them, the rabbit cringed and hoped for the best. Cujo felt several of the bats flutter against the third of him that had managed to get into the hole, and he became frightened. He didn't like their scent or their sound. He didn't like the odd heat that seemed to emanate from them. He barked louder and snapped at the things that were wheeling and squeaking around his head. His snapping jaws closed on one brown-black wing, bones thinner than those in a baby's hand, crunched. The bat flashed and bit at him, slicing open the skin of the dog's sensitive muzzle in a long, curving wound that was shaped like a question mark. A moment later, it went skittering and cartwheeling down the limestone slope, already dying. But the damage had been done. A bite from a rabid animal is most serious around the head. For rabies is a disease of the central nervous system. Dogs, more susceptible than their human masters, cannot even hope for complete protection from the inactivated virus vaccine which every veterinarian administers. And Cujo had never had a single rabies shot in his life. Not knowing this, but knowing that the unseen thing he had bitten had tasted foul and horrible, Cujo decided the game was not worth the candle. With a tremendous yank of his shoulders, he pulled himself out of the hole, causing a little avalanche of dirt. He shook himself, and more dirt and smelly, crumbled limestone flew from his pelt. Blood dripped from his muzzle. He sat down, tilted his head skyward, and uttered a single low howl. The bats exited their hole in a small brown cloud, whirled confusedly in the bright June sunshine for a couple of seconds, and then went back in to roost. They were brainless things, and within the course of 2 or 3 minutes they had forgotten all about the barking interloper and were sleeping again, hung from their heels, with their wings wrapped around their ratty little bodies like the shawls of old women. Cujo trotted away. He shook himself again. He pawed helplessly at his muzzle. The blood was already clotting, drying to a cake, but it hurt. Dogs have a sense of self-consciousness that is far out of proportion to their intelligence, and Cujo was disgusted with himself. He didn't want to go home. If he went home, one of his trinity, the man, the woman, or the boy, would see that he had done something to himself. It was possible that one of them might call him Bad Dog. And at this particular moment, he certainly considered himself to be a bad dog. So instead of going home, Cujo went down to the stream that separated Camberland from the property of Gary Pervier, the Cammer's nearest neighbor. He waded upstream. He drank deeply. He rolled over in the water, trying to get rid of the nasty taste in his mouth, trying to get rid of the dirt and the watery green stink of limestone, trying to get rid of that bad dog feeling. Little by little, he began to feel better. He came out of the stream and shook himself, the spray of water forming a momentary rainbow of breathless clarity in the air. The bad dog feeling was fading, and so was the pain in his nose. He started up toward the house to see if the boy might be around. He had gotten used to the big yellow school bus that came to pick the boy up every morning, and which dropped him back off again in mid-afternoon, but this last week the school bus had not shown up with its flashing eyes and its yelling cargo of children. The boy was always at home. Usually he was out in the barn doing things with the man. Maybe the yellow school bus had come again today. Maybe not. He would see. He had forgotten about the hole and the nasty taste of the bat wing. His nose hardly hurt at all now. Cujo breasted his way easily through the high grass of the north field, driving up an occasional bird, but not bothering to give chase. He had had his chase for the day, and his body remembered, even if his brain did not. He was a St. Bernard in his prime, 5 years old, nearly 200 pounds in weight, and now, on the morning of June 16th, 1980, he was pre-rabid. 7 days later, and 30 miles from Seven Oaks Farm in Castle Rock, two men met in a downtown Portland restaurant called the Yellow Submarine. The sub featured a large selection of hero sandwiches, pizzas, and Dagwoods in Lebanese pouches. There was a pinball machine in the back. There was a sign over the counter saying that if you could eat 2 Yellow Sub Nightmares, you ate free. Below that, in parentheses, the codicil, "If you puke, you pay," had been added. Ordinarily, there was nothing Vic Trenton would have liked better than one of the Yellow Sub's meatball heroes, but he suspected he would get nothing from today's but a really good case of acid burn. "Looks like we're going to lose the ball, doesn't it?" Vic said to the other man, who was regarding a Danish ham with a marked lack of enthusiasm. The other man was Roger Breakstone, and when he looked at food without enthusiasm, you knew that some sort of cataclysm was at hand. Roger weighed 270 pounds and had no lap when he sat down. Once, when the two of them had been in bed with the kids at camp case of the giggles, Donna had told Vic she thought Roger's lap had been shot off in Vietnam. "It looks piss poor," Roger admitted. "It looks so fucking piss poor you wouldn't believe it, Victor, old buddy. You really think making this trip will solve anything?" "Maybe not," Roger said. "But we're going to lose the Sharp account for sure if we don't go. Maybe we can salvage something, work our way back in." He bit into his sandwich. "Closing up for 10 days is going to hurt us." "You think we're not hurting now?" "Sure we're hurting, but we've got those book folks spots to shoot down at Kennebunk Beach. Lisa can handle that. I'm not entirely convinced that Lisa can handle her own love life, let alone the book folks' spots, Vic said. But even supposing she can handle it, the Your Choice Blueberry series is still hanging fire. Casco Bank and Trust, and you're supposed to meet with the head honcho from the Maine Realtors Association? That's yours. Fuck you, it's mine, Vic said. I break up every time I think of those red pants and white shoes. I kept wanting to look in the closet to see if I could find the guy's